One. Okay, we're on Daniel chapter 5, and we're going to see that suddenly Belshazzar is, he's not really the king, but he's in command at Babylon. He is the king. He's his father, Nabonidus, is the king, and Belshazzar was his co-regent. Now, the book of Nezar had died, I think it was, I'm going to look it up real quick so I'm not wrong. I think it was 562 BC. No, 550. Yeah, 562 BC, I believe. And Nabonidus didn't, because there were a couple of minor kings that didn't serve very long. And Nabonidus came king in 556 BC. He had one son, Belshazzar, and his son was co-regent with him throughout his entire time, I believe. So what we have here is Nebuchadnezzar was the king in Daniel chapter 4, and all of a sudden this Belshazzar pops up in Daniel chapter 5. So what we have is a gap of time. We don't know how much time. There's no way from the text of Daniel to be able to tell how much time it is between chapter 4 and chapter 5. But it's at least 6 years from the death of Nebuchadnezzar to the coming of Nabonidus and Belshazzar to the rule of Babylon is at least 6 years. Now, we don't know where exactly we are here in the rule of Belshazzar and Nabonidus. Nabonidus, Belshazzar's father, is not mentioned in Daniel. From what I understand from history, he spent much of his time, even though he was much older, he was quite old, he spent much of his time in the field commanding troops, and the Babylonians were warring with the Persians and others until Persia conquered Babylon in 539 BC. So Belshazzar and his father ruled Babylon for over 15, perhaps 16 years, 17, almost 17 years. So we don't know where we are here in that period of time. We have no idea where this is. We're going to see that the chapters in Daniel are even out of order here, because chapter 7 should be chapter 6, and chapter 6 should be chapter 7. So we'll probably see that. No, chapter 6 should be chapter 8. Chapter 8 should be chapter 7. Well, we're going to see that a little later to see things. But right now, we've jumped at least 20, 25 years, at least, to this period, as far as I could gather. I don't know exactly when the Book of Nezar's period of madness was. I don't think it can be told from monuments or anything like that that I've ever seen. So here we are, but we just jumped a couple of decades into the future in Daniel.
Daniel's interpretation is at the end. So should I read right through the whole chapter so we can get to the interpretation?
Yeah, why not? I don't know if there's going to be any historical notes, but why not?
Yeah, because I didn't really know where to split it up last week, remember?
Yeah. Okay. You might want to take a little pause after the vision and then move on to the interpretation.
Okay, sure. All right. Daniel chapter 5. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the god of gold, the gods of gold. and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. In the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand, and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing, nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance be changed. There is a man in your kingdom, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." End of verse 12.
Belshazzar is called the king here, but his father is actually the king. I guess he's a king because he's co-regent. That makes him the king, but it doesn't. I always wonder why the Book of Daniel never mentioned Nabonidus. Like, did Daniel ever come into contact with Nabonidus? Who knows? I don't think there's really anything that I could add to this. It's very much like the earlier visions of Nebuchadnezzar. And that's all I could say.
I don't know where I saw it, maybe in a movie or something like that, but it depicts this hand as a giant hand writing on a wall, and all you can see is the hand. But when you're reading the verse here, it's not really clear exactly what the king is seeing. It's like he can only see the fingers of a man's hand, so it could be a normal sized hand, and all he's seeing is like this hand writing on the wall. I guess that's what it sounds like. So like a floating hand writing on the wall in an unknown language, that's what the vision was, I suppose.
That's what it seems to be. The way it's described is the best that I could do. I'm never going to try to do better than that. And try to elaborate on it. Here, the Book of Nezar is called Belshazzar's father, which of course has a wider sense than we use the term father. It's very clear in history that Nabonidus was the father of Belshazzar. But a father is a grandfather, a great-grandfather, an ancestor, a male ancestor. And we know that from general scripture. It's conjectured, it's imagined that Nitocris of Babylon, this isn't definite, but it's supposed, was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and she was the mother, the wife of Nabonidus and the mother of Belshazzar. So that would be how Belshazzar is, Nebuchadnezzar is called the father of Belshazzar, because it's his maternal grandfather.
Microphone muted.
I like how it mentions that his knees are smiting against each other. Like, it might have been quite a sight to see this. I'll continue with verse 13, if no one else has anything to say.
No, that's about all I could add to this or elaborate upon.
All right. Verse 13. Then was Daniel brought in before the king. And the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which are of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Judea? I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing, and make known unto me the interpretation thereof. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee, that thou can make interpretations, and dissolve doubt. Now if you can read the writing, and make known to me the interpretation thereof, you shall be clothed with scarlet, and have a chain of gold about your neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered, and said before the king, let your gifts be to yourself, and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O thou king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appoints over it whomsoever he will. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, has not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but has lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. And they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives and thy concubines, have drunk wine in them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, have you not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the thing, Mene, God has numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and are found wanting. Perez, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. In that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. End of Daniel chapter 5.
Okay, then the chapters are more out of order than I thought, because I really didn't remember this passage was here, this last passage, but this dates this chapter to 539 BC, of course. So it must be that Daniel chapter 7, the content of Daniel chapter 7 is actually, should be placed before this chapter. It would have to be.
Right.
Because Belshazzar is still alive at the end of chapter 7. He's not alive at the end of chapter 5. That, those chapters in Daniel are, yeah, they're problematical, right?
How did they get that wrong?
I don't know. I mean, it's been like this. It's like this in the Septuagint. It's been like this for thousands of years.
It's not rocket science. I mean, like, he's dead. Order it right.
I always like to joke that some scribe was walking along with a basket of scrolls and he tripped over a rock and spilled them all out and put them back into the basket in the wrong order.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how this happened.
Microphone activated.
You know, maybe it's possible that many people have figured out that it's in the wrong order, but nobody wants to change it because of tradition.
Yeah, everyone just piggybacks on the deceptions of others and the misunderstandings. People are lazy. Right.
And it's easy for theology school students to just go along with what they're taught and repeat what they're taught, and that way they'll always get A's and they'll never have to take any risks, right? I mean, all of my writing is very risky because if I'm wrong, I'm going to look like a clown. But like, if their writing is wrong, they just look like the people that came before them for 2,000 years, and that the inertia drives them along.
It's like they're at a seminary and they're like, hey, Nehemiah came first, then Ezra. And their teacher is like, F minus F.
Yeah, right. But it's very clear right in Nehemiah that Nehemiah had to come first.
Right.
That was something that didn't take me long to figure out in prison, really. Like about the first time I read Nehemiah and Ezra. It's like, how come the city's all busted down after Ezra rebuilt it? What did Ezra do? And if you can't even get through the gates of the city on your horse or your ass or whatever you're riding, then how do you think anybody's rebuilt the walls of the city and the temple? And they never picked the rubble up out of the gates. That doesn't make any damn sense. Picking the rubble up out of the gates would be one of the first things you did before you rebuild the walls, and Nehemiah rebuilt the walls. How could he possibly come? That they usually date him to 20, 30 years after Ezra, which is ludicrous. It's ridiculous. But they don't realize that those first 6.5 chapters of Ezra are only basically a recapitulation of Nehemiah.
Yeah, we don't see Ezra's commission until like chapter 7 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, chapter 7 starts the somewhere in the middle of chapter 7 starts the contemporary part of Ezra, where he's speaking of his own time and his own governorship.
Yeah, like nobody has any guts, right?
Yeah, no one has guts because they don't want to be seen as an outsider. They don't want to be laughed out of the seminary.
Right. Well, I got a few serious papers I could defend that really should be theses for a master's degree or a PhD, but they'll never get heard in any college. And that's one of them. Nobody ever wrote that shit before. I wrote it 15 years ago. Nobody ever wrote that.
It's academic as hell. And it's extremely academic. It would be very fitting.
And I think the sad thing is that many men throughout the centuries who had guts didn't want to do things such as go through the seminary. They would do other jobs, like they were farmers or tradesmen or whatever, or they went to the military. And it was just viewed as I mean, I'm not certain, but I think it was probably viewed as something that if you really had balls, you went into some other field, because everybody down deep knew that the seminaries and the school priests were a bunch of clowns, right? I mean, that's not the best way I could describe it, but I think you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, it reminds me of how Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf that only weasels like try to even enter the realm of democracy.
Felt like nobody that's got any guts wants to be a preacher.
Yeah, that's what I mean, right?
Well, yeah.
The bottom line is I never had a chance to go to college in my life or university. I didn't finish high school. But if I'd have had a chance to go to university, the last thing I would have done was go to a seminary.
Yeah, what a waste, right?
I never got to college, but I ended up in a monastery. I think it's funny, right? I don't sweat nothing. I don't regret nothing. I was probably better off in a monastery. I didn't mess with bimbos and get diseases and shit.
Yeah, because that's what they're doing there, I'll tell you. They really are. Like, it's nasty.
Yeah, it's all about sex and partying. I know that. I've had people that spent 4 years, 8 years in universities that admitted that to me, that it was, especially the first 4 years, it was all about sex and partying.
Yeah, it's an excuse to remain an adolescent. You really should be becoming an adult.
Yeah, well... Yeah, I agree.
Most of the time, right? I mean, there are exceptions. There are guys who are in engineering and stuff that really want to do stuff, but that's they're in the minority.
But if I'd have went to a university, I never had six kids by the time I was 31. So I actually got to live that part of my life, is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
School should just end at like fifth grade. Like, they waste so much of your time as a kid.
Yeah, for most people, school should end at fifth grade because they don't have the acumen to go to a university. And that's the way it was all throughout the Middle Ages. Kids went to school for 3 or 4 years and learned the basic reading, writing, and arithmetic, and that's all they ever had to know. Only the extremely gifted young men could get a shot at going to a university, which they usually entered by the age of 16 and very often younger than that. And they would go to a university and they would study Latin and Greek and philosophy and science or whatever, that they would get a well-rounded university education, not some specialized dumbass education in some stupid shit like human resources or social work or something dumb like that.
Gender studies.
Yeah, gender studies.
Black studies.
No, it's really not that, excuse me, it's really not been that long ago that was the case, even 100 years ago. Or 75 years ago, I've been back in the late 40s, so yeah. Around 100 years ago, that was still the case. Maybe even 75.
In a lot of places it was, James, but the public school system started in communist Massachusetts, I think in the 1880s, maybe a little sooner than that, and it caught fire. You know, every state started adopting it.
Right, yeah. In the North, it was a lot sooner. I'm thinking of it from...
Microphone muted.
More from a...
A Midwest point of view. I understand that.
Right. So back 80 or 100 years ago, I remember hearing stories from people that were, you know, in their 70s or whatnot, whenever I was a kid growing up, about somebody paying for their college, or, you know, a really smart kid in school, and somebody from the community, a mayor or a businessman or whatnot, would support them and would pay for their way to go to university because they were really intelligent, you know, where, you know, otherwise they'd have been, you know, 10, 12 years old, they'd been out of school or whatnot, and they've been on the farm.
Yes. And that's where they belong.
Yeah, most kids do.
Most reading, kids. Writing, arithmetic, and farm. And if a child is has any acumen for higher study, well, that's how he should spend his leisure time.
Yeah, the university's just got out of hand. Now, anybody can go to university and get a degree, and it's not worth shit.
Right. It's a damn thing.
So these words on the... Sorry, James.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so these words on the wall, do we know their meaning? Because I think I remember once reading that they have some relation to currency or finance. Like there was some like way of balancing money or goods or something.
Yeah, we should discuss Daniel a little more. I agree. I'm sorry. But the I have to get back to this chapter. I got off, but I was looking for something. Let me back up into it. Oops, screwed that up. Mene, yeah, you know, Mene is, well, a mina. A weighter measurement of money, usually 50 shekels, but maybe 60 shekels. So Mene, it's double, right? Twice. Shekel. Is a unit of a shekel, a unit of weight or a shekel. Tekel is a shekel, I guess. And euphorsin is a half shekel to break into or divide the word. Meaning, tekel, euphorsin. And this is usually interpreted as a time. Times and half a time. And I don't remember exactly why, so I better go check it out on Clifton's site real quick.
Yeah, I think it was Clifton who I read where I read this, the whole money thing. Mene is very phonetically similar to our modern word money.
It is our modern word money.
Yeah.
It's mona, and it's mona in Hebrew. It's a word directly related to this word, and it's moneta in Latin.
Oh wow!
It's in my English from Hebrew list, and that's got to be the origin of our word money.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why it's euphorsin? I probably butchered it in verse 25, but in verse 28 it's Perez. User, is there any reason for that?
Yeah, Perez would be a part also to break into. And euphorsin, it is basically Perez with a... Wow, I don't believe they did this shit. I'm looking at the Hebrew, right? It's a vav before the word farsin, which is plural. Okay? It's basically the plural form of feres. It's feresin is the word. But there's a vav before it, and the vav is only a conjunction, but they translated it into that letter U.
Weird.
Okay, so it's vav, that then it's which is, we'll call it a U, then it's PHRS, it's the samak, not the shin, yod and nun. So it's Pharasim, and the I-N at the end is only making it plural, okay? Pharasim, so it's Pharez, right? It's the same word as the word in the next verse. And in fact, in the Douay Rheims in from the Latin and in the Greek Septuagint, it is Phares, P-H-A-R-E-S. In the Vulgate, it's F-A-R-E-S, which would be the Latin equivalent of P-H-A-R-E-S in Hebrew. So it's P-H-A-R-E-S in Douay Rheims, and it's Phares in Breton Septuagint and in the Greek of the text of the Septuagint. But the King James translators saw that vav, which just means end. And you don't have to translate it if you don't want to, if you can make sense without translating it. But it's a conjunction that means and. And they made it a letter U at the beginning of.
Yeah, they shouldn't have done that. It makes it confusing. They're like, where's the eupharsin?
And the IN on the eupharsin, that's the Hebrew plural, right? That signifies the plural in Hebrew.
Mm.
Okay. So they really blew the translation here. Sucks, as usual, King James Version. And
right.
I don't know how the hell they even did that.
Maybe they did it on purpose. That,
right? You just made me look at the Hebrew and I'm like, what the fuck?
Right. Well, I was just curious why they're different.
Yeah, well, they're not different. They're actually the same, but the King James translators dropped the ball on the first occurrence.
Yet again.
The Fall of Babylon. This is Clifton Emmaheiser. This is a reissue. I remember why he reissued this, but I remember that he reissued it, but I can't remember why. He rewrote part of it or something. I don't remember why. It was back when I first started proofreading for him that he had this problem. I don't remember what it was. This is like 1998. I don't even think I wasn't proofreading for him yet. I wasn't. I didn't proofread for him until the end of 99. So, the Fall of Babylon. The fifth chapter of Daniel gives an account of what took place in Babylon on the night when the city fell. Belshazzar, the king's son and co-regent in Babylon, was holding a feast, blasphemously misusing the gold and silver vessels taken from the temple of Jerusalem. I don't know that that's certain or how Clifton's certain about that. Suddenly, writing appeared on the wall, meaning, meaning, tekel, euphrasim, which Daniel interpreted. God has numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. The kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. History records that the Medes and Persians gained entrance to the city by diverting the river Euphrates, that's the Herodotus version, so that the riverbed became dry where it ran through the walls. In the book of Revelation, the final fall of the Babylonian system is heralded by the mystical drying up of the river Euphrates, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared, Revelation chapter 16, verse 12. Not just diverting the river, this final fall of Babylon, the river will be dried up, and the river will mean the race of people will be dried up. I think Clifton was on the right track there, but didn't quite have it, but that's all right. Now, it is interesting to note that the four words written in Chaldaic or Aramaic, when translated into Hebrew, would read mina, mina, shekel, peres, which were Hebrew weights. The gerah was the smallest weight, and the total of the above weights expressed in gerahs is 2,520, as shown below. Mina is 1,000 gerahs, and there's two of them, so that's 2,000 gerahs. A shekel is 20 gerahs, and a euphrasin is 500 gerahs. So that would be 2,520, which happens to be 7 times 360, or 7 times. So that's how Clifton got to that. His source was William V. Fowler, who actually did a lot of good stuff in Daniel, he did. And I've never had an opportunity or come across the need to verify it. So I haven't verified it, but Clifton wrote this back in 98.
Is Perez here related to the name of Perez, the son of Judah? Are they related?
Yes. And it signifies a schism or a division or to part something.
Microphone activated.
You know, I've always thought that name is Paris. Just like the Trojan Prince.
You know, that is very plausible and would explain why the French are such assholes. Generally speaking. Perez is also breach, and that's how it's interpreted in Strong's. Breach, just a breach, which is fine because it's a parting of something, right? To break or to burst or to breach.
So, and Zara was the firstborn, right, of those two? Or was it Ferez?
Zara is the one that had the scarlet thread on his wrist, but then he was born second.
So it sort of makes sense then, because Ferez sort of took his place, in a way, I guess.
He usurped him, yes. Or at least evidently, I mean, it looked like Zara was going to be born first, and he wasn't. It's almost depicted like two infants are in there struggling for who's going to get out first. Right? Same thing with Esau and Jacob.
Yeah.
Maybe it sort of represents how, contrary to the expectation of man, it's Christ who ultimately takes the throne, being a descendant of Perez. I don't know.
Hey, Bill, I got a question for you. It's kind of a sidetrack, but... So in the law, the firstborn is the one that gets the rights to pretty much everything.
The firstborn gets the rights to a lot of stuff, but not to everything quite, but that's all right.
Right, not everything, but the law of the firstborn and the rights to a lot of things. But it seems to be and maybe you've covered this somewhere before and I haven't listened to it, but there's this theme that the second born throughout, like the patriarchs, so you get, and others, where it's been the second born or the youngest has been the one to carry on or to be given. More honor or more responsibility or the inheritance.
Only on a couple of occasions.
So what's the basis for that? I mean, we can read scripture and we can see why it happened, but it seems like
I don't think it happened purposely. Esau forfeited his birthright because he was a race mixer.
Yeah, and then you have
Yahweh knew that he was going to be a race mixer, so Yahweh prophesied that to his mother that the elder would serve the younger. But that doesn't mean that it was designed that way.
And then Joseph, of course, he didn't get
Joseph was the firstborn son of the favored wife.
Yeah.
And in the ancient world, a man could have 10 wives, but would only have one wife. And the rest were secondary. And his favorite wife, it was her sons that were going to inherit what he had. Okay. And this is true of Persian kings as well as of Jacob and Israel.
Even so, disconnected from your channel. Because of his firstborn from, not the first of his born, but the first of his favored wives born.
Well, it would have been Reuben, the firstborn son, but Reuben forfeited it by taking his father's concubine.
Yeah.
And so Reuben forfeited it, so Jacob can pass it on to Joseph, and he decided to pass it on to Joseph instead of to the second oldest son with Leah.
Well, Simeon screwed up too because he went against Jacob's word, and they I think they either killed or beat those guys who raped their sister, right?
Right, which Jacob thought was untoward.
Right, and so
the Canaanites, he didn't think it was just. So Simeon didn't even get mentioned in the inheritance, in the blessings. He got nothing except the promise to be divided among Israel.
And that's how Levi became the priest of the family, even though he was a third son, because it should have been Reuben. And then Judah being the fourth, he became he got the scepter.
But Levi didn't get the priesthood according to Jacob. Jacob didn't leave Levi anything either.
But he did get it, though.
Simeon and he got it from Yahweh.
Right.
Right? So maybe Yahweh knew something about that incident that Jacob didn't know. Right?
Yeah.
That'll be my comments when I get to that part, maybe in a year or two.
Yeah, it's going to be a while.
So that will be my comments. Yahweh awarded Levi the family priesthood in the book of Exodus or the book of Numbers. I think it was Exodus. No, it was actually the book of Numbers that happened. I mean, it started with Moses and Aaron, of course, but in Exodus, but it became official in the book of Numbers. So all Jacob said about Simeon and Levi in his blessings are, Simeon and Levi are brethren. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. O my soul, come thou not into their secret, unto their assembly. Mine honor, be not thou united. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they dig down a wall. So, yeah, he punished them for not seeking their father's counsel before they made such a drastic move as to attack a whole city, right? So, cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and in their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So even though Simeon had an inheritance in Israel, it was inside of Judah. It was already scattered in Judah. And then Jacob, Levi inherited the priesthood and was scattered in Israel for that reason. But Jacob's word still succeeded, right? And the family priesthood wasn't passed down. Judah received the family rulership, and Joseph received the double portion of the inheritance. And that's all Jacob gave away, and besides the minor blessings to the other sons.
Yeah, but then later, whenever Levi got the priesthood, as you like you were saying before, you know, there was something that wasn't told there. Like Yahweh knew something that Jacob didn't, or that he didn't convey in that.
Right. Right. So Levi was chosen by God to receive the family priesthood in place of the firstborn son. But Simeon ended up with nothing. So
that's why only God can judge, only he can see all ends.
Right. So what Jacob didn't do, because of probably based on what he perceived, Yahweh did later. So in that case, I mean, in those two instances, James, it was righteous for the firstborn son not to have the inheritance, to forfeit the inheritance. It wasn't planned by God. Even if it was foreknown by God, it wasn't planned by God. He didn't do it on purpose. It teaches men a lesson, right?
Yeah, if there's any transcendental lesson here, like, it makes me think of how in the kingdom they would sin, and then they would say, Yahweh is with us. Like, no harm can come upon us because we're Israelites. And it's sort of like, yeah, you're the firstborn, but you're also going to be held accountable. You can't just think you're going to get it just because you're the firstborn. You can't go have sex with a Hittite or take your father's concubine or whatever, like just because you're the firstborn. I think that's part of the transcendental lesson there. You have to be humble. You have to follow God's law. You don't get free points.
Well, right. Obedience is necessary and should come first. Have no inheritance. Your inheritance will be removed from you. You'll be left empty-handed. You might live forever, but you'll be left empty-handed.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, and that also reminds me of the city of Lachish, which meant invincible, right? So they thought that they were invincible because they had Yahweh and they could do whatever they wanted.
Yeah. Same sort of thing. Like, oh, I'm the firstborn. I'm going to get the inheritance because I'm the firstborn. And you absolutely live a disgraceful life, or you do something horrible like what Esau did or whatever.
User entered your channel.
Okay, I think we have enough time for Daniel chapter 6, but we're getting way ahead of Daniel chapter 6 is much later after Daniel chapter 5. And after Daniel chapters 7 and 8, I mean. It makes sense to follow chapter 5, but 7 and 8 are out of place that are coming up. We're going to go back to Belshazzar, even though he's already dead, which is kind of weird.
Shall I start?
Sure. 539 BC, maybe.
Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. And then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. Then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not. Wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Then they came near and spoke before the king concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which alters not. Then answered they, and said before the king, that Daniel, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regards not thee, O king, nor the decree that you have signed, and makes his petition three times a day.
Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king, and said unto the king, Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is, that no decree nor statute which the king establishes may be changed. End of verse 15.
My memory is getting frail because I always thought this happened with Belshazzar and not with the Persians, but that's okay. Probably because the book's out of order, so I can't get Daniel straight in my head. If I ever did a New Testament, I would straighten out the chapters. I might do it. If I do a commentary on Daniel, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, I might straighten out the chapter orders.
Because I really hope you do.
All three are out of order. The Septuagint reflects a very different order chapter for Jeremiah in the later half of Jeremiah, and that's where it's out of order, but not for Ezekiel or Daniel, which are also out of order. They're the same in the Septuagint and the Masoretic text, but the order was confused at a very early time. I'm going to read real quick before you continue. Because Daniel's about to be thrown into the lion's den, or has just been thrown in.
He's about to be.
Yeah, he's about to be. Okay. So before we get there, I looked at what Comparé said. This quote, the place of execution. Comparé said, Marcel de Lafoy, who, when excavating at Babylon, fell into a pit which first appeared to be an ancient dry well. However, it was found to be one of the open cages for lions in the zoological garden. At the curb was the inscription, the place of execution where men who angered the king died, torn by wild beasts. A list of 484 men of high standing was found that were executed in this fashion. Of course, Daniel was not among them because he came out alive. So that can be taken for what it's worth. I took that quote and did a quick search for it on Google, and I actually found a couple of hits on it. And one of those hits led me to a Wikipedia page for somebody named J.O. or John Ora Kinnaman, K-I-N-N-A-M-A-N, an American Bible scholar and biblical archaeologist, born in Ohio in 1894. No, he graduated from college in Indiana in 1894 and had a PhD from the University of Rome in 1907. In Rome, Italy. Okay. Kinnaman was one of 20 people to be on the expedition led by Howard Carter that discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun in 1922, and the last remaining survivor of the expedition. He would later pursue the field of Near Eastern archaeology, where he served as a member of the Palestinian Exploration Fund of Great Britain, Vice President for the Society for the Study of the Apocrypha in Great Britain, life member of the Society of International Archaeologists, and Editor-in-Chief of the American Antiquarian and Oriental Journal, and Editor of the Bible Digest. He published 4 books on biblical archaeology, including his 1940 book, Diggers for Facts, where he compared the archaeological scene of the 1940s to the works of ancient texts, where he argued strongly for the historical exodus, dating it at 1486 BC, which is about 40 years later than I would date it, the resurrection of Jesus, as well as the second account of Daniel in the Den of Lions, which he strongly defends, particularly on page 140 of this book, Diggers for Facts, where he writes, and we mentioned this guy a week or two ago, Dr. De Lafoy, one of the archaeologists, was working one day with a rather large stone in the surface of the ground. The stone was stubborn and refused to yield to the efforts of the man. Suddenly, it gave way and Dr. De Lafoy disappeared. His co-workers found him scared, but not hurt. at the bottom of what appeared to be an ancient dry well, exactly what Tomperey had written. When the site was completely cleared, the well proved to be one of the open cages for lions in the zoological gardens, and on the base of the cage was found the following inscription: "The place of execution where men who angered the king died torn by lions, by wild beasts." Now, the adverse critic assures us that there were no lions' dens nor lions in the city of Babylon, but there it is. What are the critics going to say now? They're the words of this J.L. Kinnaman explaining this excavation by this Dr. D'Ulofoy. So there you have it. And that is Tomperey's likely source. I would have to research that a lot more and see if that was his source. I don't know if that publication is still available. I'm sure it could be checked.
Daniel praying towards Jerusalem certainly shows that the 70 weeks prophecy given to Jeremiah was on his mind. And we see that when he's praying by the river in Daniel chapter 9, he gets the prophecy there from the angel.
Yeah, he was praying probably as a symbolic gesture that he was praying for for the people of Judah and the temple of Yahweh, right?
Yeah.
Which also is long destroyed by this time.
And the arrogance here, too, like in Darius, that they're so upset that a man hasn't followed his sort of bullshit decree. And it sort of reminds me of Saul when he gives a decree that no man is going to eat for a whole night or something, that they're going to fast. And then his son Jonathan eats the honey. Like all these kings, they often have examples in their lives where they take themselves very seriously. They have quite an ego, I feel. But then we see here in Daniel, it's sort of ascribed to their culture, like the Medes and the Persians. It mentions it twice.
That there's an ancient aspect of governance that dates back to at least ancient Sumer, where the king has to exert control over the beliefs of the people and the religion of the people. So the kings and the priests have always worked together, where the king can dictate to the priests what he wants to or doesn't want the people to believe so that he could control the people. I mean, the government does it today. It's called IRS 501c3. It's the same shit, where the government can only control your thinking if they control your religion.
Mm.
They can't really control you unless they control what you believe, unless they control your religion. And that's how deep the rabbit hole is today. The all the layers of veritable bullshit that this modern pop Christianity believes is really also that the government can control them. And to make the world safe for Jewry.
Yeah, and that example you brought up, Noble, he actually did that while they were in battle. That was Saul's decree while they were in battle with, I think it was the Philistines. It may have been the Ammonites, I don't know. But which made it even worse. And then after Jonathan ate, I think some other men ate, he decided that he had to kill his own son, if you remember. Right? And then all the people stood up and said, no, you can't kill him. In the meantime, he spared the king from death that he had captured. And then Samuel had to show up and hack him to death. Right, so it's like there's no, it's unbelievable how far we can actually go when we have earthly power, like control, and we're corrupt. Like we just do the most stupid things you can imagine, right? generally speaking, as a ruler. I mean, even a really good ruler does amazingly stupid things.
All the time. But even look at the divided kingdom when Jeroboam won. Understood that the people would go over to Judah and once again obey the king of Judah if he allowed them to go to the temple to worship Yahweh.
Right.
And that's why he set up the golden calves and set up a pagan priesthood so that he could force the people to the worship of the golden calves and the pagan priesthood so that he could control the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, all to save his own ass. Like, wow.
Well, right. All to maintain his own power. And that's what kings have done that for millennia and millennia and millennia. The ancient kings of the city-states in Sumer each had their own sect of Baal worship or moon worship, the moon god Sin, or whatever they chose, Marduk, whatever, so that they could impose that sect on the people. And the priests use the priests to control the people. Even in medieval Europe, when the king became a Christian, everybody had to become a Christian. If the king remained a pagan, all his subjects remained pagan. They were told what to believe. They didn't have a choice. Oh, I want to be a Scientologist. Off with the head, in the bog. In the bog you go. You don't have a choice of what to believe.
And atheists always use it against us. Well, not us, but more so Judeo-Christians. Like, oh, I don't like religion because it's used to control people. And like, we can just say to them, like, yeah, you're right. The difference is that Christianity is not a religion in the sense you think it is. It's a covenant. It's a covenant.
Yeah, another example of the same thing is in Acts chapter 16, where they took Paul and Silas, certain of the Romans took Paul and Silas to the rulers, certain Greeks in a Roman colony in Greece took Paul and Silas to the rulers and accused them of teaching customs which are not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe, being Romans. Because if you were a Roman, you had to adhere to the state religion. You weren't allowed to believe anything else. They would kill you. If you went professing some different religion, you would die.
Yeah, they basically kill you today if you're going to school and you don't believe in evolution and you don't believe in faggots. They'll basically want to stone you.
Right. It's the same shit all over again.
Thanks for the elaboration, David, on that account from, I think it's 1 Samuel.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I think when you were talking about, they use it against Judeo-Christians, right? Because they say it's a religion and a religion is used for to control the masses and so forth, but they don't understand that they are actually controlled by a religion. So they look at it, it has to be, there's a book and then it's documented and it's been around for a few hundred years. And that's not what a religion is. A religion is whatever people actually believe in and that's their value system, right? Like you said, Christianity is not a religion, it's a covenant. So that, you know, they're actually, they are the most religious people in the world today are atheists, I would say.
Yep.
And agnostics, so that just their religion is pop culture, and that's that.
Yeah, some of them are extremely religious because, like, their religion will be, like you said, pop culture. They'll have like a statue of Darth Vader in their basement, and it's like an idol. It's like a statue. Maybe they'll light a candle to it.
Yeah, and they love the Constitution and all these other things. I mean, I can read the Constitution of the United States and say, hey, this thing's pretty good. It's a lot better than a lot of other ones. But I know it's still just a piece of paper, right? Like.
Yeah,
I don't really think it's, you know, some, you know, it's not from God, right? I mean, it has some good things in it, but come on, right? But, you know, even that, right? So they'll, whatever the law is, for example, they love the law or how stupid the law is, they're in love with it. Silly.
Democracy.
Yeah, the system, they love the system. The system's perfect.
I can continue if you guys want.
Well, if you get your values and rights from the state, then the state's like your god now.
Right.
And we see in our society, a lot of people's values just come off the TV, and there's not many who stand against those values.
But they're all state values, because the same people control the media, control the government.
If the government can force you to accept trannies, they can then force you to debase you in any way whatsoever. You know, you're not going to have any values if you've got those sorts of, you know, so-called values. You know, if you accept trannies, you're debased now, and they can do whatever they wish with you. You know, it reminds me of the time when they couldn't work out how to defeat the Israelites. So they got them drunk and made them whore after those women. And so now they're debased and their God isn't even going to stand with them because they've sinned against their God. So now they don't have any hope and they can be defeated because their values are gone. And it's sort of like that chapter of Hosea 2 where it's in Hosea 2 somewhere where it says, you know, something like, as whoredom increased, you know, the birth rates went down. They had no increase. You know, they had no increase in the people, in their cattle, in anything, because the land was being destroyed through whoredom. Like, once their values were gone and they were all whores, now the land's being destroyed. No one's having babies. Marriage is lost. Their cattle aren't increasing. They've got nothing. That's what today is, basically. With all our values are gone, and the state is our God, and the state is a cruel God with no values, and everyone's a sinner.
People deserve what they're going to get.
Yeah, I don't really feel sorry for a lot of them.
It's incredible in the United States how people worship the government. It really is. The degree to which they worship the government is really off the hook.
Well, the government has given them all these special little rights. You know, they don't get their rights and values from God. They're getting their God is the state, and the state says, just do whatever you want. If it feels good, do it. And they're like, yes, the state's given me the right to do whatever I want. No judgment. That mean old God of the Old Testament, he wouldn't let me do nothing. But the state lets me do whatever I want.
Yep. As long as you keep the IRS code.
Yep, they don't care. As long as you give them money.
Pay your taxes, be a good slave.
You know, the true God, our God, says you're in bondage to your sin. No freedom.
There was that verse from Peter where he's like, how does it go? They proclaim for themselves liberty, but they make themselves slaves of corruption. I think it is.
That's Tacitus, isn't it?
No, Peter has something like that.
Oh, yeah, Peter. Okay, yeah, that was Peter. Tacitus said something kind of similar, and I can't quite remember what it was. But yes, that's Peter. I should have.
You guys want me to finish off the chapter?
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and spat. Hate to do it, but I got to get in bed.
Okay.
All right, good night, James.
Y'all are blessed.
Good night. Y'all are blessed. Enjoyed it.
Now, this is sweet. Let me go back to 5 real quick.
User disconnected from your channel.
We're not told what year of Belshazzar it is. That's the problem. In 5, right? Now that we're in 8, we're in the third year of Belshazzar. But we didn't do 7. Daniel 7 is going to be a long chapter. You sure y'all want to start? We're in the first year of Belshazzar. So
we didn't finish Daniel 6.
Okay. I'm sorry. I thought we did. I'm getting ahead of myself.
No, we're on verse 16.
Oh, wow, that's right. We never got past that. Okay, that's where we stop. All right, now I get it. I apologize.
No problem. Okay, verse 16. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spoke and said unto Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet, and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentation, with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God, whom you serve continually, able to deliver you from the lions? Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel, and has shut the lion's mouth, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceedingly glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. And the lions had the mastery of them, and broke all their bones in pieces, wherever they came at the bottom of the den. Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. End of Daniel chapter 6.
This Darius is really just a title. It really just means ruler or something similar. But this Darius wasn't the first king of Babylon. Of course, Cyrus was for the first 10 years. I don't know if Daniel could have lived that long until 530 BC. There's no indication of how long Daniel lived. But he didn't write much after 539 BC. These two chapters, perhaps about five chapters of his book, maybe six. No, I don't know. I think it's not more than five offhand. This is something that here that I should have mentioned on verse 14. And what where it says, I'm sorry, verse 15. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. And that's true. And Herodotus attested to that in his histories, that the Persians had a law that none of their laws can be changed once they were made. So Herodotus corroborates Daniel here. And Daniel must have understood that, being an officer of the kingdom, that that law couldn't be changed, so that Daniel got screwed by circumstances. He was condemned by circumstances that were beyond Darius's control, not foreseeing what would happen to Daniel when Darius made the decree to that supported his idol, right? So Daniel didn't hold that against Darius. We see that here, that Daniel has no bitter feelings towards Darius. He'll just go down into the lion's pit and hang out for a while. So confident that Yahweh would save him, right? That Yahweh would protect him. That's a good example and a good model for our own behavior, but Daniel had no contempt for Darius. He was just confident that he would overcome it.
Microphone activated.
It seems unusual that Daniel was friendly towards an idolater. No, O king, live forever. Like, is he partly pretending? But then at the same time, the king acknowledges Daniel's God. So,
well, yes, Daniel was in captivity and he was subjecting himself to the rulers in captivity, which is what Yahweh expressed in Jeremiah that the people of Judah should do.
Darius seems to be worried about Daniel's fate.
Yes.
But if that's an example for us, does that mean, like, if our rulers are godless Freemasons, that we should pretend to be nice to them and be like, oh, no, it's cool. You can be a Freemason. It's cool. Whatever. You know, I don't.
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of example going on here where Daniel is basically saying that his God would deliver him, which basically belittles the Persian God without Daniel having to say that. So there's a certain amount here that's exemplary.
Sort of how Abel and Noah testified through their works, I guess. You've touched on that recently.
Right.
So Daniel here is testifying by his works.
And it's not that the king is sinning. The king is only acting in the manner in which he was raised and in the manner that he knew. He didn't know about Yahweh. How would Darius know that Yahweh is the one true God if he never had any instruction or experience? Up to the point where he saw Daniel survive the lion's den. So as soon as he saw Daniel survive the lion's den, he made a new decree.
I think here we see basically a reverse of the jailer in Acts, whom Paul says to that if he believes, him and his household will be saved. Because here, these men who had trapped Daniel, they clearly had no fear of Yahweh. And for what they did, it's not just them who are punished, but their households too, their wives and their children are also destroyed. So we sort of see the reverse there, that their household is punished because of their lack of belief or their lack of fear of Yahweh, rather than saved because of their belief. And then Daniel being saved here is temporal salvation and really very much what Christ meant when he said, believe and you'll be saved, because Daniel really does believe here, very confident.
Well, I think Darius realized that these men only turned Daniel in because they were jealous of him and wanted his position. And they snitched on him for that reason. They cornered Darius and forced him to execute Daniel for their own gain. And I think he realized that. And Herodotus corroborates that. Herodotus talks to the Persians in his histories and explains that if anybody disgraced Persia or offended the king of Persia with certain crimes, that they would be wiped out. And their whole village, never mind just their family, would be in danger of being destroyed as retribution for their treachery. So Herodotus sort of corroborates the fact that these men, that their wives and children were executed along with them.
It's definitely the judgment of Yahweh, though, because Yahweh stayed the mouths of the lions for Daniel, but not for these people. Yeah, Yahweh didn't save them.
Yes. Yeah, right. He made an example of those who would force his prophets to worship their idols.
Yeah. So it just sort of reminds me of like, believe and your household will be saved, or here, don't believe or don't have fear of Yahweh, and then your household might suffer along with you because of your actions as the leader of the household.
Well, death might pass over us too. And then once it's passed over us, and if we're still standing at the end of it, then our enemies are destroyed. So we're kind of like in the lion's den at the moment, and we will stand in the name of our God. And then once death passes over us, our enemies won't stand.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have temporal salvation. They don't have any protection. It's kind of like the lamb, the blood of the lamb over the doorposts. You know, death passes over the Israelites, and then once death has passed over the Israelites, it goes to the enemy's house.
Right.
They don't have any temporal salvation. They're not preserved. So if we can just stand faithfully through death, at the end of it, you know, we will be justified and our enemies will be taken. That's the pattern, isn't it, though? That's the pattern, is it's always the punishment comes upon us first, and if we're left standing after death passes over us, then our enemies destroyed.
And our enemies truly are lions. Like, behold, the adversary crawls around like a lion looking for whom he can devour. And then Paul's like, I fought beasts in Ephesus.
Yeah. He fought beasts in Ephesus. Ephesus. Because he's a racist.
Yeah.
Sorry, calling guys, them beast.
I stepped away for a minute. Are we continuing to record or no?
No, we can be finished with this. Okay. We'll come back next week and go back to Belshazzar and do the two chapters that should have been before chapter 5.